Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
The FT.
Price comparison websites are to be investigated by the city regulator. Four big investment ideas from some of the country's most eminent economists. And as Royal Mail issues its first results after flotation, we get the latest views on the shares. I'm Jonathan Ealy, and I'll be giving you all the money news this week in downloadable form with the help of my FT colleague Lucy Warwick-Ching.
Hello.
And our special guest Richard Hunter, Head of Equities at Hargreaves Lansdown.
Hello.
We've all used one at some point, either to switch energy supplier, arrange our car insurance, or compare mortgage costs. And we're all familiar with their infuriating advertising campaigns. Price comparison websites such as Go Compare, Compare the Meerkat or the Market, MoneySupermarket.com and Confused.com are big business. But how much do we actually know about how they make money? And can we be sure they are really giving us the best deal? The Financial Conduct Authority is not entirely convinced by price comparison sites and plans to investigate them. Earlier this year, the head of the FCA remarked to a Treasury Select Committee that they were all, and I quote, gamed. What exactly did he mean by that? Lucy Warwick-Ching is here to explain. Lucy, price comparison sites save millions of people time and money. So why is the FCA so concerned about the service they're providing?
Well, as you say, I mean, I think there's more than 40% of all car insurance and house insurance policies are actually bought online using one of these price comparison websites. And the problem is, as these price comparison websites have grown, so has competition for people's business. And all it's come down to now is price. Everyone is absolutely obsessed with price. So the companies themselves will do anything to appear at the top of the price comparison website. So they'll strip everything out of the insurance policy and just become the cheapest. So although when people are looking on these sites, they get very excited, they'll get something that's much cheaper than something else. Quite often people get inadequate cover, or by the time they get to the point of sale, they'll have found that these what they thought was a very cheap deal has actually gone up to a lot higher.
Okay, and that's things like motor legal protection, accident and breakdown cover, all the sort of little bits they sell as add-ons while you're going through the process, is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, let's talk a bit about who owns them and how they work. Now, MoneySupermarket.com is a listed company already, its shares are on the stock exchange, but who owns the others?
Well, this is why the FCA is looking specifically at these kind of insurance products that are being sold, because lots of these price comparison websites are actually owned by big insurance companies. So, for example, Admiral owns Confused.com, while Esure has got a 50% stake in GoCompare.com. So, I mean, as anyone, you know, thinking about this, is actually it does seem that perhaps there could be conflicts of interest with the insurers that are actually offering these products.
And how do price comparison sites make money?
Well, yes. So basically, they work on commission. You know, they call it a fee. They call it something. Money Supermarket, which is one of the few independent companies that, so it's not tied to an insurance group, as you say. It receives a flat fee, which it calls a success-based marketing fee. And this is every time a customer buys a product, it doesn't actually matter how much the product is. So there isn't an incentive for Money Supermarket to actually sell you the most expensive product. They will get a fee anyway, whether the product costs £2,000 or £200. And it seems that most of these price comparison websites work along the same lines. But the problem is that these fees are very opaque, really. No one really knows how much fee they get. So instead of something like in the fund management industry, we know that fund managers get a certain percentage of how much you're spending on a commission. With price comparison websites, we don't really know how much they're getting.
So that's never disclosed to the consumer. Yeah. Okay. Now, what effect could this FCA probe have on the sector? I mean, we've seen a huge number of price comparison sites launch over the past few years. They compete very vigorously for customers. They spend fortunes on advertising. What effect could an investigation have on the industry?
Well, I mean, I think it's very likely to put on hold any ambitions that these companies have had of stock market flotations, at least until next year, when the review, which the FCA is carrying out this review of 14 price comparison websites. I mean, it's supposed to come to its conclusions next year. So I don't think we'll see any excitement on along the lines of IPOs until then.
Thank you very much, Lucy. You can read more about the world of price comparison websites on our website at ft.com/money. It's free to use, provided you register, which allows you to read 8 articles each month. Still to come on the show, what's the outlook for Royal Mail shares as the company posts its first results since listing on the stock market? But first, let's think big picture. Earlier this week, the FT gathered 4 eminent economists together to get their views on where the global economy is heading. We deliberately encouraged them to be as outrageous as possible, and they didn't disappoint. First up was Jim O'Neill, formerly of Goldman Sachs and famous for coining the term BRICS and for his fervent support of Manchester United. Here's what he had to say about global economic growth prospects.
The marginal changes in what China is doing is so much more important, and I could go on and on again, yet as I've done so many times, about what the marginal shift in China's GDP and indeed consumption means to the world. But if they were to grow at 7.5% this decade, which is what I've assumed, that would have the global impact as if the US were growing by 4, which from what I can see, and I've been checking this recently for some work I'm doing, the US has never done that in my lifetime, over a decade. And that's what China is doing at slower growth. And very importantly, in contrast to the other 3 BRIC countries, China is so far growing by more than that this decade. The other 3 have disappointed my expectations, but China is actually doing better than what I thought. So unless China really slows down a lot more than seems to be such consensus chatter in the markets, it seems to me China's contribution to the world is going to get bigger and bigger, even though people don't seem to still realise it. Put it in the BRIC context, the past 2 years, a joke about this is sort of that China and India is a bit like comparing Man United and Man City, or it was. China's created another India in the past 2 years.
Now, the outlook for the UK has improved materially in the past few months. Stephanie Flanders, who will be familiar to many of you as the face of the BBC's economics coverage, but is now working as a strategist at JP Morgan, thinks that the outlook for the UK could get better still, and that we've been far too pessimistic about prospects for our hometown economy.
Interestingly, even when I suggested this, the mood around the UK economy was less optimistic than it is now, and I think, you know, people are becoming more upbeat about the UK, and quite rightly so. I think we always make the mistake in the lead up to any crisis of, in economic terms, mistaking the cycle for the trend, thinking that the good times will carry on forever. But then we always also make the opposite mistake, or especially if something drags on for a while, of assuming the bad times will carry on forever. And I think that happily we've now moved away from that depressed state in the UK, but I would argue we're still not nearly optimistic enough, and indeed to be more optimistic about growth is not to be unrealistic from any kind of historical perspective. I was just looking at the latest set of independent forecasts that the Treasury collates on the UK. The fastest forecast for next year is still 3%. Now, that assumption, to assume that we can it's the most we can hope for is around 3% growth next year, may be plausible, but to expect that to be the best we could achieve for the next few years, and indeed maybe the peak of what we could achieve, and maybe go back to of sort of 2% growth over the next few years, which most forecasters seem to think, I think assumes not only that we will sort of struggle to put this financial crisis behind us, which may sound plausible to a lot of people, but that we will have more permanent damage to our economy and find more of our loss of output in the last few years irrecoverable than we have ever had in modern history, whether it's World War I, World War II, the 1920s, the Great Depression, OPEC. None of these things prevented us from getting back to our previous trend growth rate, and getting not just getting back to our previous trend growth rate, but getting back the output we lost in the period of a recession.
Alas, the prospects for the Eurozone are nowhere near so bright. Here's what Martin Wolf, the FT's chief economics commentator, who describes the Eurozone as a masochist's paradise, had to say about the chances of it eventually breaking up.
What are the possible ways out of it? Well, one possible way out is that the Eurozone becomes a genuine transfer union. That's not going to happen. It's absolutely clear that's not going to happen. The second possibility is that the Eurozone becomes what I've called an adjustment union. By that I mean that there's really symmetrical adjustment with rapid growth in demand and rapid rise in relative wages and prices in the creditor countries. It's absolutely clear that won't happen. In fact, Jens Weidmann has made it completely clear if there's any sign of serious credit growth in Germany, he's going to use his macroprudential tools to kill it. And I promise you that. I've heard him say that. So the third possibility is the Eurozone remains, out of sheer terror of the consequences of departure, the masochist paradise it is today. And the fourth possibility is that at some point, completely unpredictably, some event, possibly a government actually pushed into default, which Willem Buiten thinks is very likely, possibly some election that nobody foresees, somebody says, in a serious country like Italy or Spain, we've had enough of this. We've just had enough of this. We're out of this. And quite suddenly, as Rudiger Dornbusch used to say, the great thing about financial crises is they take much longer to get to than you think. And when they happen much more quickly than you imagine. And quite suddenly, everybody says, this really was a stupid idea. Let's end it.
And finally, it's long been accepted that the free movement of capital is central to the economic prosperity. But Ellen Ray, a professor of economics at the London Business School, said that's not so. She contends that there is precious little evidence that global flows of hot money have brought any economic benefit at all. And here she explains why.
Since the 1990s, capital flows have increased really exponentially in size, particularly portfolio debt and portfolio equity flows, and also bank flows. So it is to such an extent that if we look at cross-border investment position data in the 80s, for advanced economies, they were about 60% of GDP. And in 2007, they were up to 450% of GDP of advanced economies. Now, that means that these are literally trillions of dollars that have crossed borders. And yet, it has been extraordinarily difficult for economists to identify the economic benefits that came for these flows. And this is despite the fact that numerous studies have been done in academia.
There's lots more on these big ideas and how to turn them into investment strategies with recommendations on individual funds from leading advisors in this weekend's FT Money. FT Money is part of the Weekend FT, which, don't forget, is available on Sunday as well as Saturday. You can also read it on all major tablet platforms and online at ft.com/money. On to our final item for today. Earlier this week, Royal Mail posted its first results since floating on the stock market, covering the 6 months ending on September the 30th. The Postal Service said operating profit doubled in the period compared to the same period a year ago, although it did caution that a warm summer affected the level of parcels business. Meanwhile, the controversy over the company's initial public offering rumbles on, with Business Secretary Vince Cable hauled before the Commons Business Committee this week to justify the pricing in particular. The shares are now up 60% on their listing price, and one of the banks involved in the flotation, UBS, has now said they are high enough. So what should ordinary investors make of all of this? I'm joined now by Richard Hunter, Head of Equities at Hargreaves Lansdown. Richard, what do these results tell us about how Royal Mail is doing?
I think it's fair to say Romeo's doing very well. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the results, and indeed a number of the key metrics are certainly moving in the right direction. The concern, if any, is around valuation. As we know, since the 330 offer price was announced, the shares are currently up nearly 70%, whilst even from the very first mark on the first day of trading, the shares are up 24%. On a sort of earnings basis, they're around, depending on which figures you use, around 15, 16, so they're not outrageously expensive. However, and equally importantly, they're not outrageously cheap. And from a technical point of view, because the price has risen so far so fast, the dividend yield has gone in the opposite direction, and that was one of the main attractions for Royal Mail at the beginning. So the dividend yield at the moment is around 3.5%, which of course is still robust enough given the current interest rate environment, but compares rather less well with some of its European peers, such as Deutsche Post, where the dividend yield is around 6% as we speak. So it's probably no surprise, given the absolute spike we've seen in the share price, that the general market view of Royal Mail is that they're no more than a hold at these levels.
Okay, now you mentioned the yield there, which of course was a very big attraction of the shares when they floated. I think at the float price the yield was well over 6%. 3.5% is around about in line with the market generally. So if you got shares in the IPO and you still hold them, you're sitting on a 70-odd% gain, what should you do? Should you hang on to them, or is now a good time to sell?
I think there's an argument for both. As I say, the general market view is that you hold on to the shares, but this is not likely to be a high growth company. So as ever, it's a question of whether you require the money. And certainly, were you to divest of your holding, you're sitting on an extremely tidy profit. So there is an argument for both. From an investment case point of view, the only one that we've excluded from that is whether to buy the shares. And of course, there aren't too many analysts out there currently suggesting that course of action at the moment. So I think on balance, given that there are still prospects longer term for Royal Mail, not least of which is through online shopping fulfilment, that the market call of a hold for the shares is probably the right one.
Okay, and finally, are there any clouds on the horizon for the business? I notice in the results statement that they haven't yet reached a formal agreement with the union, and also there are some concerns about rising competition.
Competition, particularly in the parcels area, is especially fierce. In addition, of course, some of its rivals don't have the burden of the Universal Postal Service overhanging them, which of course Royal Mail has got. And of course another thing is that a big bulk of its business at the moment is the letters business, and that's one where the decline is gradual, but there's no doubt that the letters business is in terminal decline. So it's very important over the longer term that Royal Mail replaces that income by consolidating its parcels business. So there certainly are some clouds on the investment horizon.
And just finally, Richard, at the time of the next review, it's still pretty much certain that that Royal Mail will become a FTSE 100 constituent, is that right?
It seems that way. I mean, at the current price of, let's say, 558, that gives it a market cap of £5.6 billion, which, all things being equal, should quite comfortably catapult it into the FTSE 100. And indeed, with that in mind, could have been responsible for some of the buying pressure we've seen since flotation, whereby institutions anticipating that Royal Mail would become a FTSE 100 constituent have been buying the shares, especially those which are index trackers.
Thank you, Richard. That was Richard Hunter, Head of Equities at Hargreaves Lansdowne. The best analysis of Royal Mail's results and share price prospects is, of course, on FT.com and in this weekend's FT Money. We've lots more in this weekend's issue too that we haven't got time to talk about today. The premature ending, for instance, of the government's funding for lending scheme for mortgages. Our fascinating Q&A session with the Pensions Minister, Steve Webb. We look at the lavish promises made by the Scottish National Party to Scottish voters around pensions and childcare. And finally, my column looks ahead to next week's autumn statement, and we've also a piece on how to profit from smoking, assuming, of course, that you are comfortable making money from a product that kills people. And on that cheery note, it's goodbye from me, goodbye from Lucy, and goodbye from Richard Hunter of Hargreaves Lansdown.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.